Several days ago, I reported on an incredible story, a sensational find in the Egyptian desert of a long-lost Gospel of Judas, offering still another version of the most notorious biblical betrayal that Jesus asked Judas to turn him over to be crucified. Judas may be the good guy. Is it all true? In a moment, we're going to be talking with an expert, Dr. Ken Hansen, about this, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and some other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. The New York Times is reporting tonight that when the National Geographic Society announced to great fanfare last week that it had gained access to a 1,700-year-old document known as the Gospel of Judas, it described how a deteriorating manuscript unearthed in Egypt 3 decades ago had made its way through the shady alleys of Antiquities Market to a safe deposit box on Long Island and eventually to a Swiss art dealer who rescued it from obscurity. But, as the Times reports, there's even more to the story. The art dealer was detained several years ago in an unrelated Italian antiquity smuggling investigation. And after she failed to profit from the sale of the gospel in the private market, she struck a deal with a foundation run by her lawyer that would let her make about as much as she would have made on that sale or more. Later, the National Geographic Society paid the foundation to restore the manuscript and bought the rights to the text and story about the discovery. As part of her arrangement with the foundation, the dealer stands to gain $1 to $2 million from those National Geographic projects, and maybe more. But no one is, by the way, questioning the authenticity of the Judas Gospel, which depicts Judas Iscariot not as a betrayer of Judas, of Jesus, but as his favored disciple. Now, Dr. Ken Hansen is an author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. He has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in a politically volatile region of northern Galilee, and taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural settlement. He was also working with a television news gathering operation in a war zone in southern Iran and southern Lebanon at the height of the civil war that left the jewel of the Mediterranean in ruins. Having been up close and personal with the face of terrorism, Dr. Hansen lends a timeless perspective to the challenges of the future. Currently serving at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, where he teaches courses on Jewish history from ancient times through the 20th century, including the rise of Israel and the Holocaust. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Ken. How are you? Welcome back.
Doing great, George. Good to be with you.
You too. This story, the Gospel of Judas, where nobody's really questioning its authenticity, is an incredible story, but it's been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, the text itself has. It is more than amazing. I've worked with ancient texts for decades now, and you reach a point where you really think just about everything that could be found has been found. And people always ask, is it possible that some other manuscript that we didn't know about might still be out there and might still surface? And I kind of chuckle and say, well, yes, anything's possible, but really inside very much doubting it. And what happens? What happens? Out of nowhere, literally, we have the surfacing of a 1,700-year-old document. And while there's all manner of intrigue connected with it, as you rightly point out, nonetheless, there's no question that the document itself is authentic. It is that old, and it's remarkable, out of the blue.
Does it vindicate Judas, or does it merely confuse the issue again?
Well, I think the issue has always been confused and will remain confused. I've been a little bit of a fan of Judas, I might add, secretly. I don't like the idea of dumping on one character in the biblical text and saying this person is now to be villainized. It's kind of refreshing, as a matter of fact, to read this text. I think that people are going to have to reevaluate this very fascinating character who has been terribly misunderstood down through the ages.
Now, why or how was Judas fingered for getting Christ crucified in the first place?
The story is told in the traditional Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that here we have a disciple who secretly connived in cahoots with the Romans and with the religious Jewish leaders of the day to betray Jesus, to turn him over as an agitator, as a troublemaker, in return for some money. And we all know about the 30 pieces of silver that he received. Mm-hmm. And this was the great betrayal. It's interesting that we're talking about it on this night. This is the night of the Jewish Passover, as a matter of fact. And that was precisely the night when, in the traditional gospel account, Judas betrayed Jesus. Jesus had the Passover meal with his disciples. He went out to the famous Garden of Gethsemane, and that is the point where he is arrested by the Roman authorities. Judas is responsible, so the original Gospels tell us.
Is it possible that those Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John truly believed that Judas betrayed Jesus, that maybe they weren't informed that this was an arranged situation?
But it does look as though there's something arranged when we read the text itself. In John's gospel, as a matter of fact, Jesus looks at Judas and he says, "What you do, do quickly." It sounds as though, reading between the lines, that in fact, even the traditional accounts suggest that something might have been arranged here. The question is why. We also have to bear in mind that in the ancient world, there was no such thing as a single Christianity. Now, this shocks people. When Christianity developed, it developed slowly, and there was no orthodoxy. There was no single Christian church. There was no Christianity. There were Christianities, and the scholarly world is increasingly aware of that roaring fact. Nobody had one single idea about anything. It was all a matter of stories that came down, of traditions that were recounted, and then subsequent editors trying to piece it all together and put it all together, this tradition here, that tradition there, and everybody disagreeing, and different groups having profoundly different ideologies and theologies. It was a big cauldron, a big mix.
The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were they physically written by, and have they been obtained by us now, by these individuals, or were they written by other people based on the stories they believe they were told?
There's endless scholarly research regarding Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, especially the three synoptics, as they're called, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which came down to us in Greek, and yet there's some very good scholarship going on in the Middle East, in the land of Israel, and interestingly enough, by Jewish scholars who are fascinated with the historical Jesus. Can we find the real Jesus of history through all of the folklore and all of the stories and all of the theology? Can we find this man? And they're looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke in the Greek, and they're saying this looks to us very much like it was translated from some earlier missing source, probably in either Aramaic or, in fact, Hebrew, a missing gospel of Jesus. We don't know who wrote this. We have no idea. It was subsequently translated to Greek, and then the Greek was retranslated and then split up. And what we call Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we really don't have much of a clue as to who finally put them together at the very end of the day.
Could it have been put together, Ken, by a great storyteller? I mean, we look at great scripts here in Hollywood, and you wonder, well, are they real, or did someone make that up? And then you watch the movie, you know, by just watching it, what happened here, what the direction of the script was. Is it possible that whoever wrote these stories down after years just made up some of the things?
Well, as a scholar, I have to hedge my bets and say, yeah, that is possible. I know that is profoundly disappointing to a lot of folks out there who like to take these as verbatim, literal accounts. But when you can't prove it, when you can't demonstrate it for sure, you have to back off a little bit and say, you know, yeah, as a matter of fact, there's not a text that we have that has not been edited by an editorial hand. And whenever somebody edits a text, they're thinking, now, who is the readership here? Who is my audience?
Absolutely.
As a writer myself, I know this rule. Who is my audience? And you've got to frame a story in a compelling way. And sometimes, let's not say that they're lying, but sometimes they're selectively depicting the story the way they want, using the facts that they want. And some traditions are ignored entirely. What we've got in the Gospel of Judas is a compelling reference that there might, in fact, have been a very ancient tradition going back at least as far as the second century of the Common Era. That's very early, very close to the life of Jesus himself. We've got an ancient tradition ignored by the other Gospels, but now here it is that Jesus, in fact, had some kind of special relationship with Judas that he did not have with the others, a very close, intimate, special relationship that he shared things with Judas, that he taught Judas mystical teachings that he did not share with anybody else, and one of those had to do with his impending execution, that he knew this had to happen, and to that extent, Judas was commissioned. This is amazing.
Do you think that because I'm trying to set the scene for this before we go back to the Gospel of Judas, do you think that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John might then have been written by one person? Or four people, or a number of people.
Okay, it's a little complicated.
Based on what they think they heard.
Yeah, my feeling is that we have a missing undertext, let's call it, in a Semitic language, either Aramaic or, in fact, likely Hebrew,
okay,
that was probably put down by a single hand. And then that text was copied and translated into Greek. And then that Greek text was split up, and at that point, we've got several hands. We've got several editorial hands, but it all goes back to some early and missing document, a biography, probably by one hand.
It could have been one of the disciples who might have been the author.
It could, in fact, have been. And by the way, this is a bit off the subject, but my own feeling is that there were not 12. Judas was one of the 12. My own feeling is that there was a 13th, the beloved disciple who is introduced in our traditional Gospels, who is separate from any of the others, and was, in fact, a 13th and extremely close disciple.
All right, we'll talk about that, too, tonight. Now then, the Gospel of Judas, if you assume that the original writings were done by one person, before they went, you know, they were written in Greek and then moved along. Is it possible then to assume that the Gospel of Judas, it also was written by that same person in the beginning?
That's harder to say. It looks like that the text that has come down to us, that has really just surfaced amazingly in the last week officially.
Right.
This is a Coptic text that goes back to an original Greek source. This happens a lot, where a text will get translated to another language, then the original lost. In this case, we've got Coptic, which is sort of an Egyptian language that was translated from an earlier Greek manuscript. The Greek is lost. So we're not looking necessarily at an original Hebrew or Aramaic or Semitic source, but a Greek source that probably came out of a whole group of early Christians. Again, there were Christianities in the plural, the Gnostics, Gnostic Christianity, which was a huge, huge block of ancient Christendom in those days, and different groups among the Gnostics. There was one very interesting and mysterious group known as the Cainites, who apparently decided that some of the evil characters in the Bible we shouldn't really look at as so terribly devious and evil. For example, Cain, who killed his brother Abel. That was the first murder in the Bible. And Judas. Maybe these people we can look at, in fact, as heroes in a way. And they called themselves the Cainites. They were a group of Gnostic Christians who lived a little bit further to the west than the rest of the Palestinian Jewish Christians in the land of Israel, a separate group entirely, who had their own traditions. And yet here we've got a tradition about Judas that again, is compellingly ancient.
What year did those Cainites live?
We're talking the first couple of centuries of the Common Era, right in the formative period of Christianity.
So that
the
would
very
be,
beginning,
right? Would that be B.C.?
No, no, this is A.D. We in the academic world, we call it Common Era or C.E. We're a little politically correct, but it's the same as A.D.
Well, I guess I was talking about the Cain portion. What year might we have been talking about there? Cain and Abel, of course, being the descendants of Adam and Eve,
right.
Obviously they wouldn't be in the A.D. version.
Well, okay, but these people lived in the A.D. period, but these stories going back to the very earliest patriarchs, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, continued to float around. So these people just picked up those stories and said,
yeah, no, those people, I agree, lived in the A.D. period. But I mean,
they called themselves the Cainites.
If one had to give a time period to the existence of Abel and Cain, for example, when do you think that would be? That would be B.C., but what period?
That depends when you place Adam and Eve, assuming there were an Adam and Eve historically. The very cradle of civilization going way back to ancient Babylonia and maybe before that. We get into a different topic there. How old is humanity?
What does Ken Hansen think? 3,000 B.C.? 4,000? 5,000?
Yeah, easily 3,000. I have to hedge my bets. I'm open-minded. Show me more evidence about 5,000, and I'll believe you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the Gospel of Judas, what exactly, Ken, is it?
We've got papyrus manuscripts, essentially, found in a cave, believe it or not, in Egypt, near a place called El Minya, in a cavern by a farmer back in the 1970s. This is the kind of thing that comes out of a Indiana Jones movie.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yet, you know, what they say, you know, truth being stranger than fiction, you could not make this up. This farmer finds it in Egypt. The thing floats around in the antiquities market through a lot of intrigue, makes it to several different countries, including the United States, where it sits in a safe deposit box for years and years before it finally goes on to Zurich, Switzerland, and as you mentioned, the entire intrigue involving now the National Geographic Society, but originally discovered out of nowhere, out of the blue, in the 1970s, that long ago, and it took all this time for it to wend its way from a shoebox to a safe deposit box to various hands and finally get into the hands through Yale universities and National Geographic Society of people who can properly piece the thing together. And that work has been going on for several years now. It's only within the last week that it's finally been in a condition of being unveiled as a complete document because the papyrus itself was so brittle, it was in such a bad condition, just to touch it, it would crumble into pieces, very much like Dead Sea Scroll material, which also ended up in thousands of little tiny pieces. You have to put this together as the world's biggest jigsaw puzzle.
If the gospel is accurate, and Judas was a friend of Jesus, and that Jesus and Judas somehow conspired to put this crucifixion together, that Judas had to go and turn him in order for it to occur, doesn't that damper a little bit the story of Jesus and the crucifixion and the reasons why he was crucified?
Well, a good story needs a foil, needs a hero, it also needs a villain. And as you mentioned, the later editors who set down the synoptic gospels as we traditionally have them certainly like to play on the hero-villain, the hero and the foil. You go to a movie and you want a villain that you can really hate so that when that villain, when that heavy goes down, you're cheering. And that's what you want in the Gospels. This is quite a bit more sophisticated. It doesn't change anything about the idea of a salvific meaning of the sacrifice of Jesus. But what it changes is how we look at the betrayal. Maybe, in fact, Jesus himself was being liberated from his fleshly garment, being liberated into a spiritual being
that
can dwell in all of us.
Hold on to that. Now I'm going to ask you if Judas really did kill himself. We'll be back. Well, they put the rest of the April edition of the After Dark newsletter, which is the special edition with Alex Jones in there. They're now working on May. I'm working on my editorial for May as well. I think I'm going to do something on Ed Dame's Dr. Doom. You can get 14 issues for the price of 12. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Ken Hansen, our guest. Ken, history tells us that after Judas sold Christ, basically, for the 30 pieces of silver, he hung himself on a tree branch. Is that true, or do you think that changes?
Well, I've got the actual text of the Gospel of Judas in front of me, and when we follow it on to the end of the document, we get the story about the people coming to arrest Jesus, to arrest him during prayer. They approached Judas. They said to him, "What are you doing here? You are Jesus' disciple." Judas answered them, and he received some money and handed him over to them. Interestingly enough, that's where the text ends.
Ah.
It doesn't say anything more about what happened to Judas. And oftentimes I find that a text is just as compelling or more compelling for what it does not say than for what it does say. However, earlier in this new and yet ancient gospel, we've got a conversation between Jesus and Judas because, again, we're told that they had a very special, a very close, intimate relationship, and Jesus is sharing specific mysteries with him. And Jesus says to Judas, "You will become the 13th, presumably 13th disciple." We mentioned in the previous segment about the possibility that there, in fact, were not 12, but 13 disciples. You will be the 13th, and you will be cursed by the other generations. But then Jesus goes on and says, "And you will come to rule over them. In the last days, they will curse your ascent to the holy generation." Now,
I got to tell you, as a layman like I am, you're the expert here. In the last days, they'll curse your ascent. Now, to me, one could say, okay, now we know about this Gospel of Judas. It's making him look better, and people are going to curse that. Some people will.
Well, you bet they will. In fact, I just got an email now from someone who's very upset about
this. Are they blaming you? You're only a messenger here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm as surprised as anybody else by the fact that this text has surfaced. I did not expect this. But here we've got these mysterious words, and they are real. The text is genuine. The question is, what do we make of them?
Are we in the midst now of end times, even based on this?
Well, the folks who wrote these texts, and there is a whole library of other ancient texts out there, believe me, seem to be convinced that the end times, quote-unquote, were already beginning in their days, that this was it, that there was a profound disillusionment in the idea that things were getting better. I'm afraid they're not. And we need to look toward a culmination of all of world history. And so they give us many clues and many prophecies, but they believe that even in ancient times, we're talking the first couple of centuries, A.D., we call it Common Era, that the end times were underway. And if you follow this text, that is definitely in line with what the Gnostics were teaching.
Now, how do we know that, or how did the story of Judas hanging himself even occur? I mean, did that come from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or was that made up?
It probably came from this Semitic undertext that I mentioned. It's only theorized. We can't prove that there was such a mysterious text that subsequently got translated to Greek and then disappeared. But I can tell you that there's some very good scholarship going on by, again, Jewish scholars, amazingly, in the land of Israel who think it existed. It was probably part of that early tradition. But then again, what is the writer trying to communicate and to whom? What is his audience? There was not a single Christianity. There were Christianities. It was not an orthodoxy, but a heterodoxy. And what you had going on in the land of Israel was a little bit different than what we find going on in Egypt, for example, where you had these other groups, the Cainites, for example, the Gnostics. They had their own traditions that came down separately and independently, and sometimes they conflict. And one of the most important differences is that they feel that we as human beings have been endowed with a little piece of the divine presence that has emanated from the Big Bang, essentially. And that peace has lodged within every human being. And that what salvation amounts to is not some thing out there that you go to church and find on Sunday, and you lose again. You got to come back and find it again.
Right.
It's not what I hate to call it this, but let's do it, hell insurance. That's not what salvation really should be understood as. It's discovering that spark of the divine fullness inside of us. And it's that process of self-discovery that is utterly liberating. Even at the point of our death, we are liberated. And that's the ultimate. And so when Jesus dies, according to the Gospel of Judas, he's in a sense, he's shedding the outer skin. There's a fascinating part of this text that where Jesus says to Judas, "You will exceed all of them," speaking of the other disciples. "You will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." Now, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Jesus says, "You will sacrifice the man that clothes me." The idea is that even Jesus, as a spiritual being, was clothed with flesh, clothed with a man. And so, Judas, you're going to betray me, you're going to turn me in, that's fine, because I was born to this. The outer man is to be sacrificed. The man who clothes me is to be sacrificed, so that the reality of the divine presence can come forth and spill forth. That's the message that's trying to be conveyed. So the fate of Judas in the end, whether he hangs himself or not, is really irrelevant. The point is this: let's discover who we are, and rather than seeking villains that we can point the finger at and blame, let's look to the divine instead.
Does Jesus tell Judas that he will teach him or show him the mysteries of the universe?
He not only tells him this, but in fact he reveals to him the mysteries of the universe throughout this text. It's incredible. He really lays out the entire Gnostic idea of this Big Bang, as I call it, in the beginning, and the emanation of the divine fullness through a series of, call them divine beings. The Gnostics call them aeons, and that terminology appears in oodles of ancient texts. We already know about the way they thought. But the same exact terminology now appears in this new Gospel of Judas. The aeons, a series of, you can think of them as angels, but let's call them divine emanations from the Almighty. And Jesus is revealing even the names of these aeons to Judas, and only to Judas. And by the way, we know from other Gnostic texts that one of these aeons became Adam.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Well, take us through this portion. I find this to be very fascinating, Ken. Take us through the portion, basically, where he talks about the Big Bang and how things evolve, these mysteries of the universe.
Yeah. It's incredible to see how the ancient cosmology, in some ways, dovetails with modern astrophysics. It's almost spooky to go there in scholarship, because we're supposed to stay away from that kind of those kind of goosebump conclusions. But it really is amazing. that the divine, rather than sitting up on a throne with a long beard and deciding what to create, it didn't happen that way. There was an emanation of the divine, not a direct creation, but God emanates into everything. And that's this series of aeons who together form what is called the Pleroma. The Pleroma is the divine fullness. And some of these concepts dovetail with ancient Jewish mysticism, with what we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, with the entire discipline we call Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, that speaks of the same idea, uses different terminology, of course, but the idea of emanation is there, emanating into everything. And then together, if we can somehow even reconstruct the pieces of the divine fullness, we can form the Pleroma again and bring about what we can call a real salvation at the end of the age.
Does he talk about extraterrestrial life, Ken, that there are beings on other planets in the universe?
He talks about other beings. Now, at that point, again, as scholars, we have to hedge, and we have to say, you have the permission to go there, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You definitely
sure
have
is.
The permission to go there, because we have extraterrestrial beings all over the place, and in this text as well.
What does he say there? Were you able to break that down for us?
There are so many things up there. The various spirits he's talking about, those whose spirits did not dare to stand before God, but only Judas did. He did have the chutzpah, as we call it, to stand before. And then these secrets are revealed. There's a vision of a divine temple. There is an interpretation of that vision. Cosmology. Let me get to the point about cosmology here.
This is the good stuff.
And I've got the text in front of me. There exists a great and boundless realm whose extent no generation of angels has seen, in which there is a great invisible spirit, which no eye of an angel has ever seen, no thought of the heart has ever comprehended. And then we get to more of this, which dovetails with the idea of the Gnostics. But here's what it says: a great angel, the enlightened, divine, self-generated, emerged from the cloud. Now that's interesting, isn't it?
Yep, sounds like a craft.
Well, I can't say that as a scholar, but I give you permission, George.
Thank you so much, Ken.
Because of him, four other angels came into being from another cloud, and they became attendants for the angelic self-generated. The self-generated said, let come into being, and then we've got the text is mangled at that point. We can't read it. Something about coming into being, and it says, and he created the first luminary to reign over him, something luminous to reign over him. And these are all the secrets now that Jesus is revealing to Judas only. Let an enlightened aeon, there's the term I was talking about.
Right.
Let an enlightened aeon come into being. And he came into being. He created the second luminary to reign over him, together with myriads of angels without number to offer sacrifice. That is how he created the rest of the enlightened aeons. He made them to reign over them, and he created them, myriads without number, to assist them.
Does he talk about the fallen angels at all, about Lucifer, Satan?
Not in this particular text. He names specific angels. He gives them names. One is called Adamas, and it's hauntingly similar to the Hebrew word Adama, which means earth. So again, the text is so sparse in what it tells us and also what it doesn't tell us. Could this be some reference to the angels who fell? Now, the Gnostics did have a very well-developed, let's call it folklore, about angelic beings who came to the earth, who cohabited with earth women and spawned a race of half-breeds.
Right.
of giants. And we're told from other Gnostic sources, not from this one, but from other books, I call it the Lost Bible, and I've written an entire book on the secrets of the Lost Bible. We have other books that mention this in detail and say that this race of beings from the fallen angels actually was responsible for the sending of the flood, because they began to devour human flesh. And if God had not sent the flood of Noah to destroy them, they would have eaten us all.
There were cannibals?
Apparently, who grew to monstrous size, 300 cubits tall. Again, I'm referencing other texts now. Here we've got this mysterious Adamas, which means the earth. So is this one that fell to the earth? I can't weigh in on that. But it says he was in the first luminous cloud. That luminous cloud again. Isn't that interesting, George?
Yeah.
that no angel has ever seen. As a scholar, of course, I just report. You decide.
I will decide. That's exactly
that no angel has ever seen among all those called God. And then it goes on and talks about 72 luminaries who appear in the incorruptible generation. And then,
wouldn't it be incredible, Ken, if Jesus in this gospel is talking to Judas, telling him about extraterrestrial life, verifying that craft has come down to the planet, talking to him about a bigger picture? I mean, it's absolutely startling.
It is. And I can't say as a scholar that Jesus said these words verbatim. Again, we have so many different traditions and they conflict. But what I can say is that this text is extremely old. We're talking earlier than 180 of the Common Era, that is A.D., and does reflect ancient traditions that were out there. Whether you want to believe that Jesus said this verbatim is really not as important as the fact that these people had these traditions. The traditions existed.
Does it get into Revelation as John did?
In the sense that it does talk about the end, yes. It's not as specific as John. Again, the text has suffered a lot of decay.
And you're talking about physical decay. Okay.
Yes, physical decay, right. But it certainly talks about the end, the last days that I already mentioned. Much of it's just a word here, a word there, but you can tell it is definitely apocalyptic.
This is just an absolute startling revelation all
it's
by
startling.
Itself.
It's startling.
For it to come out around Easter, Passover, also, I mean, yeah. They've got to have timed it this way, don't you think?
Could be. Yeah, it certainly could be. But I believe in miracles, too. So,
did they talk about, in the Gospel of Judas, the crucifixion and the resurrection?
It's basically understood. In other words, that part of the story is already known to the audience, so they're not going over that specifically. They're filling in the pieces that you wouldn't have gotten elsewhere, and that seems to be the purpose.
Does it kind of attest to the fact that Jesus was indeed a different person, maybe the Son of Man, Son of God, but that he had very strong supernatural powers?
It mentions specifically the expression Son of God, and that the disciples were acknowledging him this way. It also says that he often did not appear to his disciples as himself. Then it says, but he was found among them as a child.
He had this ability to shapeshift.
Apparently. And that's what the text is suggesting to us, although it might be purely metaphysical in the sense of the spirit of the child coming through him. You have to take these on different levels, and that's the trouble with it, but also the beauty of it, that you cannot say it means specifically one thing only.
How important do you think this gospel is now compared to the other four?
Huge. It's huge. Because of its antiquity, because of its recentness, because it's attested to as early as Bishop Athanasius in 180 A.D., this will send shockwaves, no question.
Stay with us. Dr. Ken Hansen, when we come back, Let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And also, you have now perked my interest. I want to talk with you about the fallen angels and these giants that apparently were cannibals. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.